time to tell me the truth, to burden your mouth for what you say, and pieces of paper in the way.
Welcome to Between the Lines, a monthly magazine show on the third Thursday of every month at 2 p.m. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. My show this month consists of a conversation with Susan Orlean, author, journalist and staff writer at The New Yorker, and she's fast becoming a kind of national treasure, just like the subject of her latest book, the biographical Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend, the paperback version of which comes out on October the 9th. This long-time Hudson Valley resident is also the author of several non-fiction books, the best known of which, The Orchid Thief, was made into a very quirky and critically acclaimed movie adaptation in which Susan Orlean herself is actually portrayed on screen by Meryl Streep. Not many writers can claim that kind of fame. Susan has also been anointed the Twitter Queen by the Nieman Foundation for Journalism, while Time magazine lists her among the 140 top most popular Twitterers for 2011. In an interview I recorded earlier, she talks about writing Rin Tin Tin, about what life is like on the road promoting the book, about her infamous Twitter habits, and about how the Hudson Valley has influenced her writing and her great love of animals. And I'm very privileged to have her on the show this month.
So brave is Corporal Rusty, though he is just a boy. How true is Private Rin Tin Tin? They are the Army's pride and joy. Yo, Rinny, yo, Rinny, pass through thick and thin. From all the tales of the West, we'll remember best Corporal Rusty and Private Rin Tin Tin.
The paperback version of Rin Tin Tin is comes out on October the 9th, so congratulations about that. That must be very exciting.
It is. It's always really exciting when the paperback comes out, because I think every author knows that it just reaches a very... such a broader audience when you put it out in that form, and it's almost like the whole book comes alive again.
Which it's born
is
again.
Really thrilling, yes, it's great.
Now, I have to be honest, I haven't finished it yet, but also, interestingly, I'm not really a dog person, but I found myself completely enthralled with the tale. I was particularly, I was just sort of enraptured right from the beginning when... those wonderful descriptions that you had of the dogs in World War One, and they all had their different functions. And some of them had little carrier pigeons, and some were, you know, transporting medical supplies. So I just thought you did a fantastic job with that.
Well, thank you. And I, you know, when I wrote the book, I never went into it assuming that a reader would have to like dogs to appreciate it. To me, it really was a piece of popular history told through the lens of this iconic dog. And, you know, the whole history, I mean, as you say, in World War One, it just gives you such a sense of what the circumstances were of the war, given that there were 16 million animals being used, that dogs were participating in such a variety of ways. I think for me it was a chance to really picture that world for the first time in a very real way.
And the book was quite a long time in the making. Was it about 8 years or something?
Certainly was. It was a very long time. It took what felt like a century.
Did you expect it to be such a long journey?
When I went into it, to begin with, I had no idea of the breadth of this story. I really didn't. And that's part of what made it very exciting to kind of go in not knowing what I would find. But it also meant that I just wasn't prepared to suddenly find myself needing to learn about the history of World War One, to learn about the entire evolution of Hollywood, to learn about the development of the German Shepherd dog. There were so many things that I needed to learn in order to tell the story. So it just grew and grew. And there were plenty of times where I was very frustrated and felt like it was just taking too much of my life. But I felt that there's a big difference between a one-year book and an eight-year book. And the depth of research that you can do just requires a huge amount of time.
I mean, the hardback came out back in September 2011. Do you feel that you've been talking about it a long time now? Does it still feel fresh to you? Or does it sort of, the information get a bit old? Do you feel you want to move on at all?
You know, that's a good question. It's really a combination. I still get very excited, and especially because there are so many ways to talk about the book. You know, some people really want to talk about the early part of the story. Other people, you know, bring up the later part of the story. So there's a pretty wide range. So I haven't gotten tired of it. I also think there's such a great feeling when you finally finish a book you've worked on for so long that you've got a lot of energy that's simply out of the feeling that you've cast off this albatross and, you know, moved. It just makes you feel like you've lost 50 pounds, and that gives you a lot of energy. But, you know, to be honest with you, in this day and age, it's so wonderful when a book has a life that goes on, because it's a tough world out there, and there are, I believe, 100,000 books published every year, and most of them come and go in the blink of an eye. So to be still talking about it a year later, I take as a huge compliment, and I'm thrilled.
Yes, it definitely has legs, so to speak.
Yes, four long ones.
Yeah, I read, I think, in one of your tweets that there's a Rin Tin Tin documentary in the works.
Yes, I'm working with a producer developing it now, which is really exciting because there's extraordinary material out there that's, you know, very visual, and I think it would make a great documentary.
I mean, the book was so visual, I kept just seeing movie scenes in my head, especially after seeing The Artist.
Right.
Did that ever occur to you? Did you think about going the movie route again?
Yes, and I've talked to a lot of producers who do fictional film, and I, you know, have had some really interesting meetings with them. Most of them are a little daunted by the scope of the material. I mean, it is an almost 100-year story that I've followed. So right now, I've got a lot of people very interested and slightly intimidated by how they would actually tackle the project. And I'm not a screenwriter, so they need to find a screenwriter who can say, I figured it out.
You're ready, thou's too thick and thin. From all the tales of the West, we'll remember best Corporal Rusty and Private Rin Tin Tin.
It's Pledge Month. If you haven't made a pledge, please go and do so now. Like, call immediately. Now. Just do it. Just do it. If you like what you're listening to, if you like the thought of having a show that just probes people, that asks them questions, that interviews people you'd like to interview. If you like the idea of having a show that, you know, in which you can just listen to Susan Orlean talk about her writing habits, then please call in now. Just do it now, okay?
And The Orchid Thief, of course, was not only one of your biggest kind of non-fiction and most well-known successes, it was also made into a very successful film. Did you enjoy your whole dealings with Hollywood? How was the experience for you?
I'm probably one of the very rare writers who feels that she has had a very genial relationship with Hollywood, that I take it all with many grains of salt, so I don't let myself get dragged in into the emotions and the ups and downs, because it's a very different business from writing a book. A book is one writer with one keyboard. A movie is a collaboration of an immense number of people, an immense amount of money, and the complications of making any movie are so enormous that if you let yourself get caught up in it, you will inevitably be frustrated. And I've somehow gotten lucky in that I let it happen or not happen, and I love the movies that have been made from my work. I feel that adaptation is a fantastic movie. It's not a conventional version of my book, but that makes me happy too. And I think I've just been sort of lucky that I take this all with a certain bemused distance, and then it's just all upside for me. And I don't set out to write things to be made into books, rather into movies, so I don't have a lot riding on it in that way. And, you know, the irony is that it ends up happening only, I think, because you're not trying.
I also read somewhere that you actually wrote a screenplay with your husband, who, of course, is John Gillespie, a former merchant banker. Is that right?
Yes. We did this, gosh, I guess it was about 7 or 8 years ago, and it was something that he was actually more interested in doing than I was, although I thought it would be fun to collaborate. And to be honest, some producers really pursued us and wanted us to write a story about our courtship, and of course the script ended up having absolutely no resemblance whatsoever to our courtship. But you know, you start out with an idea, and then it just kind of goes off in its own direction. But it was a really interesting experience. It was commissioned by DreamWorks, and I felt that I had a real education on a very different form of writing, which fascinated me, although not so much that it's something I'd really want to jump to do again. And I had a great time working out with my husband. He, in spite of his banking profession, he's a fabulous writer, and he's done a fair amount of writing, so it's not as completely unexpected as it might sound. He was a writer before he became a banker. It's almost like he became a banker as a sort of second career, and that his first love is as a writer.
And now, you mentioned this courtship, which I understand was somewhat peripatetic. You had sort of dates all over the world.
We did. I mean, it sounds, it's funny because it comes with some explanation, but we were living, I was living in New York, he was living in Boston. To begin with, just seeing each other at all required traveling between the two cities. And then he had a business trip in Brazil, and for our equivalent of really our second date, he invited me to come with him. So then I, in turn, had an assignment to go to Thailand, so I invited him to go with me to Thailand. And then we thought, well, let's keep doing this. This is exciting. I mean, we can just go on dates. You know, we're going to try to go to every continent. And I then had to go to Australia, but unfortunately, and we thought, well, this is great. We'll get that continent. But unfortunately, he had a work conflict. So our plan to try, because we went to London also, and, you know, we really were having fun with this idea that we were going to try to get to every continent within the first year of our courtship. But we didn't quite do it. We missed a few along the way, but we figure we can still pick them up and throw them into the hat.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Between the Lines on WJXC. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper, and it's our pledge drive. So if you haven't called up and contributed, please show your appreciation by calling 518-828-0290. And the music you were listening to was from the movie adaptation by composer Cartwell Burwell, or Burl, as you Americans say. Did I mention it's Pledge Drive week, the end of our Pledge Drive? So please call in 518-828-0290. And we are going back with talking to Susan Orlean, New Yorker author and writer of Rin Tin Tin, The Life and Legend, whom I interviewed via the phone about a couple of weeks ago.
Your focus has really always been on non-fiction and sort of long-form magazine journalism. I mean, have you ever tried writing a novel? Do you write short stories at all?
I don't. I love fiction. I wrote a lot of poetry at one time, but I have never written fiction, which sounds probably surprises a lot of people, but I just haven't. Even though I read like crazy and my nine times out of ten, what I'm reading is fiction. But I think that they are really such different enterprises that I think some of the skills I have as a nonfiction writer are entirely different from what's required to be a good fiction writer. And I think, you know, there have been times when I've had an idea and I've toyed with it a little and thought, oh, maybe I should just try it already and not be so put off by it. But I just, as it happens, I just haven't done it.
I mean, it sounds like you may have to wait till the kind of you come across the right theme or the right passion. As I understand that a lot of your writing has to do with following certain themes and coming, as with Rin Tin Tin, you came across something that really sort of spoke to you, the idea of writing about this dog after seeing the little statue on your or the little toy on your grandfather's mantelpiece.
Yes, I think that, you know, I'm driven by a curiosity, and I think with fiction, you go into it with such a different set of questions that you're asking, and I'm, you know, very much a reporter. I go out and try to answer questions, and so that's really different from fiction.
Now, when you go out to report on a story, do you come up, to what extent do you come up with stories, and to what extent is it your long-term employer, the New Yorker, that suggests the stories?
I would say it's about 99% my ideas and 1% stories that they bring to me. And out of my 99%, occasionally those are stories that a friend might mention, you know, that I come across somehow other than just my own ideas. You know, I feel like coming up with ideas is a huge part of what I do. And it's very hard for someone to propose an idea to me that feels like it fits right. And the New Yorker, you know, fortunately has kind of always said to me, you come up with your ideas, but it's mostly my ambitions to answer questions about something.
And you're listening to Between the Lines, and I'm Anne Forbes Cooper on WGXC, and it's our pledge drive. Yes, we only do this about three times a year, and we're mostly volunteers here, and we do it because we love it, and we love you, our audience, and we hope that you love listening too. So please show your appreciation by making a pledge now. Just do it. Call 518-828-0290. And you have been listening to Susan Orlean, who is a New Yorker writer and the author of the Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend, and the forthcoming paperback out on October the 9th. And she's talking about her love of the Hudson Valley and the making of the movie, and her reputation as the Twitter queen. And if you like listening to this kind of program, give us a call, 518-828-0290.
What are you currently working on?
Right now I am working on two big things. One is gearing up for the paperback release of Rin Tin Tin. And the other is reading as a judge for the National Book Awards in nonfiction. So I've spent a great deal of the summer reading, and that's been very overwhelming. I mean, right now I'm making my way through about 100 books, and it's a little bit like a crash course on every single nonfiction subject you can imagine. but I took the summer off from my own writing, you know, just to have a break, and that's been really great.
You mentioned that you are surrounded by boxes, and packing up, and clearly travel is such a huge theme in your life. But I should just preface this by saying you have been a long-time Hudson Valley dweller, Columbia County, to be precise. You rented a house there for many years, I believe, before you and your husband bought the land and built the house that you live in now. How long have you actually lived here in the Hudson Valley?
My guess is that I first began renting the little cottage that I rented for many years probably in 89 or perhaps 1990. So it's been a really long time. And we bought this land in 2001 and built our house. It was completed, I think it was 2005, the house was done. I mean, we weren't building it, you know, between buying the land and getting a design and having the construction, it was kind of a big project. But during that entire time, we continued renting the cottage because the land is right across the street from the cottage that I had rented for so many years.
So what does the Hudson Valley mean to you?
Well, I feel connected here in a very profound way. I've been here longer than I've lived anywhere else because I left New York City in 2003, but continued having this connection here all that time. So it has a sort of permanence in my life that, you know, even though I've moved and right now we're spending the school year in California and we always seem to be going somewhere. I mean, we were weekenders up here for a long, long time. We lived here full-time for 5 years, year-round. And, you know, I feel like I can't imagine ever not having a connection to the area.
And you accumulated quite a menagerie there. You
had
chickens, dogs, and horses. And
dogs, cats, cows, turkeys, ducks, geese. What I'm still angling for is I really want a donkey. And every summer, my husband promises me that this will be the summer that we'll get the donkey, but that hasn't happened yet. But right now, we have quite a few things to take care of, and you know, it's a big job. I mean, I love the animals. They definitely are work, but they're also a lot of pleasure. You know, I go out and visit my poultry a couple times a day and just say hello and toss them some corn and, you know, just visit with them. And it's part of what's wonderful about living up here. You know, it's just having that opportunity to have not just cats and dogs, but livestock.
Has the Hudson Valley influenced your writing at all?
You know, that's hard to say. I certainly think that living up here while I was writing Rin Tin Tin was significant. First of all, living among animals as I was writing about an animal. And I think the feeling that I was kind of in an otherworldly place when I was writing about these very different worlds of World War One and the 50s. And, you know, it had, I do think that, you know, obviously the Hudson Valley isn't otherworldly, but it kind of moves at its own pace. And I think I felt that very much working on this book up here.
And if you're just joining us, you are listening to Between the Lines on WGXC at 90.7 FM. And yes, we are towards the end of our pledge drive. So please call in 518-828-0290. Did I mention it was our pledge drive? So just do it. Just call up and pledge, all right? Just do it.
Now you moved to, is it Culver City, California?
No, we're in Los Angeles.
Oh, you're in Los Angeles. I beg your pardon.
Yes.
Why? Why did you move from, it's almost like the extreme or the sublime to the extreme?
It is very extreme. I mean, my feeling is if you're going to move, you might as well have it be very extreme. But This was very specific, which was my husband got involved with a startup company out there. So it wasn't just, we didn't throw a dart at a map and go. And we didn't leave thinking, that's it, we're fed up, we need to go move into the middle of the most congested city in America. It was very much specific to this work that my husband was doing. And I was, you know, I love California. I happen to love Los Angeles. I was eager for the experience of living there, because it was a place that I liked a lot. We had bought a house there some years ago because we have a lot of friends and were out there quite a bit when I was working on Rin Tin Tin. I had so much research that I had to do in California that we were out there a lot. So it sounds like the most preposterous, most unexpected move imaginable, and yet for us there was an actual logic that followed, you know, that just isn't evident from the exterior.
What about the chickens? Did you take the chickens to L.A.?
No, I wanted to. I was very tempted. We have a lot of coyotes in our neighborhood in L.A., and I just didn't like the idea of attracting. I mean, I have a young son, and I thought the last thing I want is to attract coyotes into my yard. They were already wandering around the backyard. Mm-hmm. So we decided, you know, we thought, we're not sure how long we're staying. Let's not uproot and drag all the animals there. So we, you know, we took our dog, we took two of our three cats, and then we have house sitters who are taking care of the animals while we're away.
Okay. And how often do you manage to get back here?
Well, we've just been back here for, you know, the whole summer. We were leaving a little early because the school year in California starts very early. And we were back a couple of times in the fall. We had planned to come for Christmas break, but at that point I just finished a 26-city book tour, and the idea of getting on another airplane was not at all appealing to me, no matter where it was taking me. So we didn't come back for Christmas.
Right. Yes, I read about that, a bit about that book tour, or else I kept sort of plotting all the different cities that you were in. That really was quite an extraordinary tour. I'm assuming that you like traveling, that you like visiting lots of different cities. And
yeah, I mean, you know, when you're traveling for a book tour, you really don't get to see where you are, unfortunately. You know, you have these great illusions that you're going to be seeing Denver and seeing Chicago and seeing the places that you're visiting, but you don't, really, unfortunately. But I don't mind. It's just such a different kind of traveling. You know, it's very purposeful. You're really focused on wanting to get the book out in the world, and I hit the wall at the end of the tour. I just suddenly thought, I cannot do this one more time. But luckily, it hit me when I had one more city left, and I was just really happy to be home. But it was a very intense tour, you know, with lots of very tight schedules going from city to city. And there were a lot of nights where I'd wake up and have no idea of where I was. I mean, I literally would think, I'm in a hotel, but I don't remember where we are right now.
Yeah, which state.
Yes, and, you know, I've learned, you know, I've done a number of book tours, so I've also learned how to do it in a way that's, you know, I don't go thinking, gee, I'm going to do some sightseeing while I'm in Chicago. I do my work, and then I generally, you know, get room service and watch bad television for the few hours that I have, you know, I'm still able to stay awake, and then I just kind of conk out. It's a very, it's not nearly as exciting as it sounds.
It's
hard work, really hard work.
Yeah. And traditionally, I mean, some writers hate it, and others just love it, and some are sort of in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't hate it. I don't mind it, and I feel I really like it when I have an event and it goes well. I'm really excited and happy and feel very energized. I mean, I love the idea that people are responding to something I've written. So in that way, I really love it. But I wouldn't say that I would opt to be a traveling salesman in my next life.
The other aspect of your life that I just want to ask you about is that you, of course, are a Twitter queen. According to the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University. And you're also on Time magazine's list of the top 140 Twitterers of 2011.
Isn't that crazy? it's kind of a crazy thing. I never would have imagined in a million years find myself with those titles. And, you know, it's something that I took on really for fun and without much of an idea even of what social media was all about, and found myself, you know, first of all, enjoying it, and secondly, quite unexpectedly, you know, having people scrape and bow and tell me that I did it very well, which I thought, wow, that's amazing. I don't know what it is that I'm doing, but I'm happy to have you tell me that I'm doing it well.
Whatever it is, you are a complete natural. I mean, you even asked your followers you crowdsourced a commencement speech that you had to make recently.
Yes. Well, I got a big kick out of hearing what people, you know, one of the fun aspects of social media is that it's a conversation, and I'm happy to be told that I do it well, but I also feel strongly that it goes both ways. You get a lot of response from people. So I guess really what it draws on is a lot of the same qualities that, you know, a nonfiction writer might have, which is a capacity and interest for talking to people, to engaging them and, you know, encouraging them to talk back. So that part of it feels very much to me like what I'm doing anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it feels like it's not very hard, because, well, this is sort of what I do for a living.
Yeah, so it's sort of an extension of your personality and your work life, your natural inclinations.
Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, finding it fun and not finding it puzzling. I think a lot of people are puzzled, like what is appropriate to say on Twitter? And I think, well, just whatever you feel like. And it takes some time to get comfortable with the form. It's a bit of an odd form. It doesn't feel unnatural to me. I guess that's my... if I have any skill at it, it's just that it feels like a very natural conversation, which, of course, it's, you know, it's weird. Of course, it's not. But if you picture it as being a natural conversation, it's a lot of fun.
And on your account, it says that you have done something like 19,995 tweets, which is almost like it's about, what, two or three novels worth of characters right there, you know?
I know. I've thought about the fact that I really ought to just compile it all, publish it as a book, and, you know, chalk it up as another work in progress. Unfortunately, there's no through line exactly, but I think we could work around that.
Yeah, because you do have, what was it, 229,428 followers as well. So clearly there's an audience out there for your tweets.
Yeah, it's so funny, and I'm very flattered. I mean, it's enormously flattering, and if people enjoy it, I'm thrilled, and I don't think it's a huge surprise that people who write for a living find the form a kind of natural one. I think similarly, there are lots and lots of comedians who are on Twitter, and it's sort of the same thing. It's like doing stand-up. So those are very logical, I think. So there are ways you can use it that fit all what you're already doing.
Yeah.
And I think for people in those professions, it's a pretty natural fit.
One of the best pieces of advice I heard you give on Twitter was actually to writers, and you suggested you to post your daily count on Twitter. It will shame you into finishing, which as a writer myself, I absolutely love, but I haven't done it yet. So,
well, it really works. It really is. You know, it's the equivalent of weighing yourself every day and then writing it on the wall with a big, thick black crayon. There's certain things like getting a book done that require a lot of willpower. And if you have people, first of all, cheering you on to accomplish something and also, you know, making you feel, all right, you've made the statement, you're going to do it. Now you really feel like you're going to do it. I mean, we all know that that's human psychology. It really works that way. And having people, you know, sharing a goal with other people increases your likelihood of achieving it enormously.
Do you think it's an addiction? Could you stop? Could you go cold turkey?
Sure. It's one of those funny hypotheticals because I always think, gee, if I had to stop eating chocolate, could I? And then I think, certainly I could, but why would I want to? But I think that there are times when I'll go for a day or so and I haven't tweeted and I'm conscious of it. I think when you have a lot of followers, you become more aware of the fact that people, you know, begin to wonder if you haven't tweeted for a while. So it becomes an extension of work in that regard. But I definitely don't feel addicted. I think in the beginning it was such a crazy new form that I was much more, I was thinking in tweets and trying to picture what I was going to tweet. And now that I've done it for as long as I have and I'm much more, and I'm so familiar with it, I don't have that same feeling of being so distracted where something happens, I think, ooh, that could be a tweet. That I could tweet that.
So tweets just sort of come upon you at all times of the day or night. And
yeah, I mean, there are times when I am deliberately thinking, okay, I'd like to post something, what's going on? But more often, I'll see something, I'll think of something, or I like to complain on Twitter a lot, just about things in my life, like having my computer not behave, or this morning I thought I had washed my pedometer, I thought I had left it on my pants when I had washed my pants, and, you know, I feel that that's something that you want to share with people. And then, of course, I found it and realized that I made this big fuss about ruining it in the washing machine when, in fact, it was sitting on my dresser. So, you know, that was cause of further embarrassment. So, but it's all in a day of tweeting, you know. I feel like it's kind of a choreography of bits that, you know, that are just things that float in and out, some that are more serious, some that are just purely meant to be funny, and some that are just observational.
What's your writing schedule? Do you work in the mornings, evenings, or what?
I usually get going midday. You know, I settle in mid-morning and really hit my stride usually around the middle of the day. Before I had a son, I did a lot of work into the evening, you know, and I found that a very good time to work, but it just isn't a really practical. And now I find, it used to be that I'd put them to, you know, I'd read to them, put them to sleep, and then think I would go back to work, but I could never do it. Mm-hmm. I just would be too sleepy, and, you know, so my ability to work at night is pretty much is shot.
How do you think your writing has evolved over the years?
I think that I've developed a lot more confidence, which makes me looser and more, I feel just a lot more in that I'm able to take chances, but at the same time I feel that I'm in control, which is funny. And I've learned my habits and my bad habits so well that I've become a pretty good self-editor. I see my weaknesses much more immediately now. So I guess that those are probably the ways that I've evolved the most. I think certain things just haven't changed at all in terms of the way I write, the way I go about a story. Those have remained really the same since the day I started work as a writer. I just have a certain sort of way of going about a story that I do every time, for better or worse.
What would you say your biggest challenge is in writing these days?
Finding something that I really love, you know, staying energized by it, and then making sure I don't feel that I'm repeating myself, which, you know, when you've written a lot, as I have, there's always this fear that you're not doing anything new, or that you're just going over the same territory, that there's nothing fresh in what you're saying, or that you're even something as simple as feeling that you've used the same words too many times. So you just need to keep expanding your toolkit and just keeping yourself excited about it.
Would you describe yourself as an ambitious person when it comes to writing in your career?
Well, I certainly was. I think I was extremely ambitious. And I think now I have goals and standards that are pretty punishing and pretty challenging, but they're somewhat different from the kind of ambition that I had when I was younger, where I dreamed of having stories in certain places and getting to know certain editors. And, you know, now my ambitions are more internal, about pushing my work more and feeling satisfaction. And, you know, it's just a different kind of ambition.
Well, Susan Orlean, I want to thank you very much indeed for taking the time to do this interview. It's been fantastic to have you come and share some of your life with us today.
My pleasure. It's been terrific.
And of course, the paperback version of Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend, is out on October the 9th. And I'll let you get back to your packing your boxes.
And you probably heard my dog barking.
Yes, I heard the dog barking.
She has something on her mind, too,
so we'll have to
get that all sorted out. But it's been a real pleasure. I really appreciate it.
And that was my show for this month, and I want to thank you for listening. And once again, I really want to thank Susan Orlean, who's just an absolute delight to talk to. And I will be back on the third Thursday in October at 2 p.m., on WGXC. And don't forget to pledge. Have I mentioned it's the pledge drive?
Time to tell me the truth, to burden your mouth for what you say, and pieces of paper in the way.